Thank you very much, and also welcome to Boston. We have a fond place in our hearts at Harvard for Boston and for you coming here, so thank you very much for coming to these sessions. I would first like to acknowledge my collaborators. I would like to acknowledge Mary Pettigrew, who worked with us from the Department of Public Health, State of Connecticut, and I would also like to acknowledge my colleague, Dr. Elena Savoia, who's here in the front row, who is the Deputy Director of the Preparedness and Emergency Response Learning Center at the Harvard School of Public Health. Also, I would like to acknowledge the funding from the CDC to our Learning Center, and just to make sure the contents are the responsibility of the authors and do not reflect the CDC's point of view. One of the critical responsibilities of public health departments is to identify groups vulnerable to hazards that could negatively impact the lives, the health, the economy, and the environment of the jurisdictions they serve. And in an effort to prepare, health departments are increasingly conducting hazard vulnerability and jurisdictional risk assessments. I'm going to abbreviate that throughout this presentation by HVJR, particularly for public health emergency preparedness and mitigation planning. Now, however, as we've seen in many areas of public health practice, the integration and adoption of these types of analytical assessments into practice are relatively rare. Part of the goal of our project had a fundamental basis in education. Because HVJR assessments are complex, they often require the review and input of hundreds of pieces of both objective and subjective ratings. It's this complexity that makes it difficult for our public health workers to understand the underlying measurement and models. And so while we take for granted that measurement, analytical, and causal inference methods are common in public health research, they really have not been widely utilized in public health preparedness and mitigation planning. So there were really two objectives to our project. One was to develop the measurement, geospatial, and mechanistic models to aid our public health practitioners in understanding HVJR assessment, and to also improve the validity and reliability of both objective data and subjective ratings that are used in these assessments, and also to evaluate the feasibility of using these methods for dynamic and predictive HVJR analyses. So our methods, we had systematic review of the existing HVJR tools that are out there. We then looked at those, evaluated them, and developed our mechanistic or causal inference models. We utilized geospatial mapping. We then adopted a structural equation modeling approach, and we applied these really pilot procedures to the State of Connecticut Public Health HVJR assessment and analysis. So for the systematic review, what we did was we identified the most frequently used HVJR assessment tools. And there are many groups that have used these tools in the past, primarily emergency management and hospitals. The tools are relatively new to the public health departments. We then went through these tools, and they exist, I'll show you, is primarily questionnaires and Excel spreadsheets. We evaluate the common components of the different assessment tools, and then we categorize the measures to construct the generic measurement model. So just for an example of some of the types of tools that were evaluated, for example, from Kaiser Permanente, since hospitals have had to do this over the years for the past several decades, there are these types of tools, a tool that really takes your event, and if you could look beyond this, beyond just the top, this is just one page of it, you have hazards in which you're rating the probability and likelihood of a hazard, the impact on humans, on property, on businesses, how prepared you are, what the internal response, and all of these are ratings that we ask our public health preparedness planners to input the data. As public health adopted these tools, we can see that one of the first centers in academics was UCLA that developed the Center for Public Health Preparedness tool and with similar types of inputs. And then one of the tools that we've used heavily is the one developed by the state of Texas Department of State Health Services. In looking at all these tools, we identified at least six domains, and these domains are used by some of the tools, but not all of them. As they evolve, you'll see that they develop more and more areas. But just to go over these six domains, there's the capabilities assessment. These are ratings that are assigned to each of the functions of public health preparedness capabilities. And there's also a list of capabilities and functions that the CDC puts out that the partners, the state partners, who get preparedness funds have to demonstrate competency in these capabilities. Also asked are ratings of the resources, to public health resources in particular, but also to healthcare and other emergency management resources. Then there are ratings of the likelihood of a particular hazard, not only ratings, but severity and magnitude of each type of hazard. Also, the public health planners are asked to rate the evaluate the severity of the consequences in terms of infrastructure, resources, public health, healthcare, and behavioral health. Another area that's important is the social vulnerability. The disaster impact is different depending upon the level of social vulnerability. We have certainly seen this in practice, looking at the recently in Hurricane Katrina and certainly Hurricane Sandy, that depending on your demographic and socioeconomic characteristics of the jurisdiction, that the impact changes. Then there's mitigation. Again, the impact is a function of mitigation. And ratings of capabilities, resources, and community resilience are also important here. Now, each one of these domains actually are then broken down into further items and data inputs. And for example, the hazard, likelihood, and severity may be based upon statistics and objective information, but also may be intuitive and highly subjective. So often, this is just an example of one area, the following resources are often considered: the known risk, historical databases, and disaster databases. For example, in the area of disaster databases, one can look at databases on natural events, on hazardous material releases, on technological accidents, on infrastructure problems, epidemics, and terrorist attacks. And here's a photo of Breezy Point area of Queens on 10/30/2012, exactly 1 year and 1 week ago today. And this is after fire destroyed 80 homes as a result of Hurricane Sandy. And even 1 year later, you can see that these areas have not even yet received the FEMA support they need. And many people are taking out loans. And so this continues. Not only will you see signs of do not enter poison signs because of the toxicity and other chemical exposures, but these last for months and for years that the public health responsibility will be one that continues after our first responders have left the scene. We use geospatial mapping and visualization primarily to inform the mechanistic model by visually examining the variability and patterns associated with county-level demographic, social, economic hazards, and resource data. It was also used to aid the public health planners when assigning subjective ratings in the HVJR assessments. So I'm going to show you the mechanistic models that we developed, and just to remind you here and to define that ovals will represent the unobservable latent variables, and the rectangles will represent the observable data variables, such as the losses and what we'll denote as V sub 1, 2, 3 for each one of these hazards, where K is the number of potential observable data. and the arrow will indicate the direction of the effect. So we actually developed many different models, and I'm going to choose a model that will be a schematic, really. It's an illustration. It was chosen because it fits on a PowerPoint slide. And there are more than five hazards here. I've listed only five just to tell you. There are more resilience ovals here. But the idea here is to have the public health worker be able to understand that these pages of Excel spreadsheets that they're filling out with ratings, numbers coming off the top of their head, and as one planner said to me, how am I expected to, I'm not a weatherman, I don't know the hazards, and they're asking them to put in numbers to give them an idea of where the data is and the concepts. So I'm going to go through each one of these levels, and here the disaster impact is level one, the hazard resilience and vulnerability is level two, the actual hazards under their blizzard tornado, that's level three, and underneath there you'll see that's where the data is input, these hundreds of pieces of data. So we have data at the outcome level, what we experience is the human, the economic, and physical loss, and we have the inputs coming into defining the disaster impact. So just going through the first one, disaster impact is what we're trying to measure. It will result in human loss, economic loss, and physical loss. That is what we see, and that is what we report. But disaster impact is a latent variable. It is fed by the other variables, as you see. But just to show you the visualization of the data, economic loss is the one I'm going to use. Here is in the analysis we did for the state of Connecticut, we have the hazards event as shown here with the darker green showing the most losses throughout the historical years from 1960 to 2009. The actual data of these will be feeding this model. At the levels 2 and 3 latent variables, we identified the three domains of hazards, resilience, and vulnerability. As I mentioned, I've only listed five of the 41 hazards that we evaluate, and I've listed five areas of vulnerability, the most common, and then pulled the other sectors into the resilience in addition to the public health. So all of these are latent variables, the hazards, the resilience, and the vulnerability, as are these, because they're going to be made up of the rating scales and information feeding in to each one of these. So hazard measurement, here is the latent variable of the hazard, and then as an example, some of the hazards that we see, specific blizzards, tornadoes, hurricanes, and what's feeding into those are the V's, V1 through V sub K, having K different possible inputs, and they include, of course, the probabilities, the severities, and the subjective ratings, and other variables that people are asked to input. Just for an example of how we try to the data underlying this, you can use maps in many different ways. Here we're focusing on Connecticut and showing here the atmospheric hazards in Connecticut. As you see here, the darker blue, the worse the atmospheric measures. I'm just going to flip through these very briefly. The hurricane tracks, and certainly you can see it going up through this region here. Part of the losses in economy has not only to do with the density of population, if we looked at this, but the tracks of hurricanes and storms, which the weather-related hazards are the most common for the state of Connecticut. I just put up hailstorms here, so give you an idea that when the public health workers can see this, and then this can be feeding the model, I think it's much more effective than putting in ratings simply off the top of their head with not connected in any way. The resilience measure, of course, now if you have the hazards, you know, what is on the opposite side of that? Well, resilience has to do with such factors as emergency response facilities. Where are your emergency response facilities in connection to the types of hazards and the probability of those hazards? So you can use these type of maps, and also you can develop your own. For example, we've fed in the location of hospitals in Connecticut to get a feel of, as you see right here, the hospitals are not only in the highly density populated part of Connecticut, but also in the hurricane track. region, and also here, for example, the nursing homes, where the nursing homes located. You know, one might be concerned about the areas along Route 95 here and the coast and the coastal surge that occurred during Hurricane Sandy, for example. Transportation facilities can also be thought of as building resilience, although it could be also thought of as a potential vulnerability depending on where they are. The next latent variable is the vulnerability variable, and this has to do with pooling the economic, the social, the demographic, the physical environment, and health areas. And just for an example here, this particular index is made up of 30 demographic and socioeconomic variables. It is through the Hazard Vulnerability Research Institute of South Carolina, and one can then look at the fact that Connecticut, relative to the nation, rates very low with regard to variability. But then within the state, if you're dealing with the jurisdiction as a state, you have the highest areas of variability represented in sort of the eastern parts and then less in the Fairfield County, but you get a feel for that. And you can do it, again, at different levels of jurisdiction. This is our Health and Human Health and Human Services Region 1. And here, again, getting down to the count of the census tract level, especially if you want to see where the pockets of vulnerability are. And these are this particular index. One of the principal components is something called poverty, and you can see where the poverty levels are. Also, for example, the elderly, and where the elderly are, and this gives the public health practitioner a better feel for the vulnerability. So here is, in fact, the entire model, and so the next step is the level 4 variables, and these are the data inputs. So this is the observable data in the area of each one of the hazards, for example, and then going back, you would do the same for resilience, and this is the data that's input. From here, we developed the structural equation models, and this is primarily to develop drills and exercises, but also hopefully for predictive use later on, so I'm not going to go into this in detail, but it's pretty standard developing the regression equations. I think one of the most important things is to notice how many equations there are, and certainly how many equations you have to solve simultaneously. This is just for level 4 equations. If one looks at the rest of these, if you go between level 3 and level 2 latent variables, you can derive similar equations, and then similar equations can be derived for level 2 latent variables and the disaster impact latent variable. I think the important thing for the practitioner to be able to see in a simulation is if you change resilience, you know, you change disaster impact, it is not something that's solely determined by the probability or severity of a hazard. If you change the vulnerability, you change disaster impact. So all these equations can be solved simultaneously to derive the path coefficients so you know the degree of effect and the degree of impact. Well, the HVJR assessments are extremely complex. If you look at any one of your epidemiologic causal inference, some of them pale in comparison to the number of systems and items that have to go into this type of planning process. So the current HVJR assessment tools translate this complex measurement into subjective ordinal rating scales, and often just summating or multiplying these ratings to attain a metric and without verifying the causal models underlying this inference. The great contribution of these tools, if they've told us what the public health practitioner and what people in emergency management consider important, and that is 95% of the work. The 5% of the work we have to do as translational scientists, I think, is help them bring this to an area where they can improve their public health planning. Also, the geospatial mapping redirects attention to the fact that the measurement of hazard vulnerability and resilience with disaster risk and the losses are reported for a particular geographical region. Also brings it very personal to the planners, to their jurisdiction. So well-developed mechanistic models could be used in conjunction with existing HVJR tools initially, which was our goal, for educational training, and ultimately technical assistance in helping our state partners build better planning documents for carrying out a dynamic predictive analysis by feeding in the data to these models on a more dynamic basis. So what are the next steps? Well, we hope to develop simulation and predictive structural equation models for specific public health preparedness training exercises. One can envision this as demonstrating that if you increase this particular resource, you have this impact on the disaster. Certainly, disaster impact is not absolute. It depends upon the components feeding that, and what we have control over primarily is the resilience component, and then in a broader scheme, the vulnerability component. And then finally, to evaluate the value of these exercises, simulations, and predictive models in improving the intermediate and longer term outcomes of disaster response and mitigation planning. So I want to thank you, and if you have time for any questions. Because as our fourth person here yet, just wanted to make sure they didn't walk into the room. Yes, thank you.
I have two questions. Number one is, which estimation do you use for the structural equation model, right?
Well, we're not using a particular one. But if you actually look into the software that is available through STATA now, which has its data, or through SPSS AMOS, you can actually look at that, and it's pretty standard of estimating the parameters of those covariances. You can, however, use the standard techniques that are used with SAS. So any one of your packages would have that in there, and then you could have your option. We're using it primarily for modeling and not estimation at this point. Well, we actually haven't done estimation with this. We're just using the modeling in a simulation approach now, so I haven't done that here.
My second question is, you have measured so many variables, also variables and land variables. Mm-hmm. Did you end up creating a map for different types of variables so that the end user can be able to know which variables are more related to which?
Well, that would go in the model, exactly. The idea is to get the beta coefficients so that you see when, for example, we got a request from the state of Connecticut to not include the hazards that the state of Connecticut doesn't experience, like wildfires, and to extent earthquakes. And so that's the measurement component. So you can see what feeds disaster impact in the state of Connecticut. If you look at the beta coefficients, again, we're doing this in a modeling sense, you would see that blizzards and hurricanes are those that feed disaster impact, primarily because those are the ones that are most likely. I mean, my very first memory as a child was of houses floating down the Naugatuck River in Connecticut. Now, if one considered my age, I was very young at the time, they say, oh, you just made that up. That was the flood of 1955, which, you know, that actually occurred. Houses floated down the Naugatuck River. So that was due to Hurricane Diane and 16.7 inches of rain that dropped down, not the winds, nothing, but in that area. So in that way, the public health planner would know that it's not just only the hurricane. You could have 16 inches of rain, which literally divided the state of Connecticut in a half. And that's what we're trying to show them, because they don't remember those things. They pretty much hazards, although they say they're relatively rare, they seem to be happening every other month. To most people, they can't put those rating scales that they're being asked to rate. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to use that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Yeah, I guess it's sort of getting into the question about what kind of software analysis to do. I think it would be important, you know, the kind of data you have, like you use AMOS or something, you know, it has to be all continuous variables, because it's correlations, you know, basically, you know, sort of just covariance matrix kind of thing. So the kind of data people put in has to be kind of like on a rating scale.
That's exactly right. All those are frankly ratings. But even for the tools that are being used, they're all on the rating scale. So the idea is you can't feed that, actually, that rating, though, with the historical data from the probability of a likelihood. So you can feed that rating scale and make that rating scale become more like a Likert item within a scale that has that normal distribution. And that's where you're trying to get to. I don't think we're at that point yet. But what they're using now is simply just the Likert rating 1 to 4, adding up a bunch of those, and then just adding them up and multiplying them together without any underlying model. That's what's currently being done in these hazard, vulnerability, and jurisdictional risk assessments now. Exactly. Exactly. So I use structural equation modeling primarily to in my work in patient outcomes research, and we're essentially, these are all continuous measures. We have not yet done it here. We're using the causal inference model and the path analysis to have a feel for it, and then we're putting in the ratings that are simulated and not, you know, estimated at this time.